Welcome to the Sounds of Success, brought to you by the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. This audio magazine is a tool for generating profitable ideas and for taking your business to new levels of excellence and performance. Here you'll find real-life case studies of school owners just like you who have applied our proven successful business and marketing principles to their school and are creating the business of their dreams as a result.
Hi, welcome to our conversation today. This is Stephen Oliver, CEO of the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. I am delighted to be joined by an old and dear friend, Buzz Durkin. Buzz, welcome to our call today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let's give everybody a little bit of background. What year did you start in martial arts? And give them a little bit of your background with that.
Well, I hope not too many people are too shocked. I started actually when I was a student at Boston College in 1966. And then I opened my school in 1974. So we're going into our 38th year of operating the dojo. And it's been a great joy and a great run. I teach an Okinawan style of karate called Weichiru. And that's what we do. And that's what we've done for the last almost 38 years now.
And you're one of the senior ranked Weichiru stylists in the country now. What's your rank? And before we go any further, we want to talk to everybody too about how many black belts you produced at that school, and how many high ranking black belts you have training. But
gosh, we've produced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of black belts at that school. I happen to be a ninth degree black belt, You know, I'll tell you, I had a morning class this morning, Stephen, a black belt class at 11:30, and there were 17 godans, fifth degree and above, in the class. So we have a lot of senior students and a lot of people who make it a lifestyle and just keep it part of who they are and what they choose to do to stay fit and healthy. We've had a darn good run of it, you know. As you know, in one of my missions early on was to elevate the view, the perception of the martial arts. And actually, back in 1988, we were one of the first in the country to build our own facility, which was a 7,200 square foot, or is a 7,200 square foot dojo, just for the purpose of teaching traditional Okinawan karate. And if you were to walk in today, like, we still get people would say, "Boy, this place looks brand new." So we call it the new building because we're in a little 1,800 square foot building for the first 14 years of our existence, saving and planning, etc. And so we've only been 23 plus years at the new place, and we call it the new building still after 23 years. Go figure.
And it's just a beautiful facility.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, I wanted it to be. We have beautiful hardwood floors, showers, lockers, and you know, one of the things that got me back in the 70s, you'll remember, we were like the poor stepchild of the health industry. At that time in particular, beautiful health clubs were springing up everywhere with showers, air conditioning, proper ventilation, proper equipment. And so many martial arts schools were on the third floor, up three or four flights of stairs, or downstairs on the rug next to the oil burner. And I just always thought that the martial arts student deserved better and a place that they could really be proud of. And that was one of our goals, to build a place like that. And we worked hard at it and had the vision, set some goals, and thank God we were able to do it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And over the years now, you know, maybe we should predicate this with you're not exactly in a major metropolitan, highly populated area. Give them a little
No,
sense
we're
of,
in a
of,
little
of
town
area.
In southern New Hampshire. Total population, 6,500.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep a student body, a student count now, Stephen, of 350 students. And at this point in time, that's what I like. That's what I can handle. That's what the families that I choose and like to work with. So at one time we had actually a couple more hundred students than that, but where we are now, we're just at 350. We keep it at that number. And I dare say we have more second and third generation family members probably than any other martial arts school in the country.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember you commented on something I wrote recently that 10 things you must do to thrive.
Yes.
And I'm sure it fits your operation pretty well. Give us some sense of what were some of the things that clicked for you in that, and how it reflects what you've been so successful with.
Well, I think our basic philosophy, which one of my mentors is Harvey McKay, went with the Sharks, etc. And he had a great philosophy, and it's really the philosophy upon which we've built our school, and that is think long-term and think in human terms. And if everyone can do that, it would make a huge difference in terms of student retention. Think long-term and think in human terms. And long-term, you know, even if you have to suffer a little financially in the short run, but it's in the other person's best interest, and they'll think better of you, they'll think highly of you, we yield in that direction. And then the other thing is, of course, we teach martial arts, but we teach people first. And every single person that walks in that door is a person with a heart, a soul, emotions, feelings. And we can never forget that. So people first, martial arts second. And we always think long term. And it's been my experience that if I ever had a challenge financially with a student or whatever, you know, we say, go with God. Or we try and remedy the situation so that the student leaves happy, even if it means our taking a loss in the short run. Because what happens is a year later they send their uncle down to study with you. You know, 2 years later their two grandchildren are down there studying with you because you treated them correctly. You know, you see them at the grocery store and they're happy and proud to see you. You don't have to look the other way. So our basic philosophy truly has been think long term and think in human terms, and that essential philosophy has really stood by us.
Absolutely, absolutely, so important. Give everybody a sense of what you're charging now for lessons.
Well, we charge $200 a month, and my school, we may do it a little different outside the norm in terms of Black Belt Club and Leadership Club and Masters Club, and some people may cringe when I tell them what we do, but it fits our culture, and it's the culture that we've developed and that works successfully for us. I just think of my school as a college. We have freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year. That's the curriculum. So we typically enroll students for a annual enrollment, and that's it, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, senior year, and then go on to graduate level. So we do everything on an annual basis, and tuition happens to be $2,400 for those who qualify for enrollment into what we call our regular program. So my Black Belt Club consists of every single student in the school, because we don't enroll somebody without the ultimate goal of being a black belt.
Right.
So I know that might be a little contradictory to the mainstream, but again, that's the culture that we've come up with, and we've been able to adapt it and make it pertinent and make it work for the students. So
what I was going to interject there is the thing that very few schools are able to replicate is the quality of student retention and the quality of the long-term relationship that you've done. It doesn't mean that they couldn't or can't, but they haven't.
Right.
And so what has happened in the industry, just to give it a little analysis for what you just said, is accelerated payments and paid in fulls are very important if you have a high dropout rate, because that way you lock people in and they prepay, and if your dropout rate tends to be fairly high, is getting prepaid for the thing frankly helps keep people there, because they're not making a financial decision if they're a little frustrated with the program, but also you get paid for more lessons than you teach. And that's really where the differentiation comes in. The second is in the quality of getting that commitment to graduation. And I've come to think of it as that there's two pieces. There's the renewal process, which is about helping people understand the training through to graduation, as you talked about, through senior year and graduating in the graduate school, and really educating and helping them understand that. And then there's the concept of an upgrade, which is finding an expanded program where you can perhaps charge more than your base level tuition. And the two things are different, and obviously you've been very, very good through the program of upgrading them in the sense of creating that commitment and creating the environment where they don't drop out.
Yes, and I can tell you how we've done that anyways. But before I do, I think every school owner has to make a key decision, and that is, what kind of a school do you want? And there's no right or wrong, really. Do you want a school where you're constantly getting new people in and people are going out, and it's like a revolving door? Or do you want a school? Do you want to enroll everybody, or do you want people to understand that martial arts is hard work and it can only be success? They can only be successful if they make a commitment to it, a commitment to themselves and to their training, and make a life-changing episode in their life through the martial arts training. I think what happens is so many schools focus so much on getting people in that not much attention, not as much as need be attention is paid to the people who are there. So we get 20, 30 people in. Well, then the focus is getting another 20, 30 in. And the people that are already there, they're not enjoying your focus. So they leave. So it's a vicious cycle that goes on. And I think the first school owner has to do I want to become an institution of learning in my community, in my city, in my whatever? And I think it's important to do that because I see so many school owners who say after 10, 15, 20 years of having a school are operating this school almost out of desperation or the same way they did in the first year. Oh, this guy has to pay in full for me to pay the phone bill. This guy has to pay in full for me to make the rent. Those types of things, that's hard work. And I think ideally, I know I wanted to be in the position where after 15, 20, 25, 30 years, whatever, the school is almost, of course we work hard, but it's almost self-fulfilling. People are wanting to come. It's much easier. Oh, you taught my grandfather. Oh, you taught my father. And we've had this happen on many occasions when a dad will come down and say, Buzz, give my son the same education you gave me. And it just makes life so much easier when you can get out of that vicious circle rut of, you know, if everyone enrolled 30 people a month and kept people, you know, every martial arts school in the country would have 5,000 people. But that's obviously not happening. So that idea of making a commitment, an understanding of what it's going to take to be successful in martial arts, when you do that and students begin to do that, they feel good about themselves. They see the benefits. They see the results. They don't want to walk away from the benefits or the results. And they want their other family members, whether it's their relatives or whether it's their immediate family or whatever, to enjoy that as well. Another thing that we've been able to do, I notice so many school owners think that the answer to retention is in the next form. The answer to retention is in, well, I'll teach them this new weapons form. I'll teach them this another style. And in my opinion, that's not what makes for outstanding retention. And I'm talking your students making it a lifestyle. It's the idea of not the next form, because that's, in the big scheme of life, that's not that important. It's the idea of using the skills they acquire in the martial arts, the patience, the confidence, the determination, the goal setting, etc., showing the students how that applies in their daily life. So if you can equate everything that goes on the dojo floor with how it'll help them make a sales call, a better project for school, a better presentation, not to get upset when they get cut off in traffic or have to deal with a rude retail clerk or something. If you can constantly reinforce that through your curriculum, whatever your curriculum is, people love that. The outside world is negative. It can really bring us down. I like to think of people coming to my school who come down to get recharged. The batteries get charged. They're surrounded by positive, life-affirming people who are filled with the vigor of life, and they're supportive and cooperative, and that charges their batteries, and then I'm able to go out and deal with the stress of my job or the stress of school or whatever. And that's what keeps people coming back, because you need it at 17, you need it at 37, you need it at 57. And if you can relate what goes on through your curriculum, whether it's confidence, whether it's patience, whether it's cooperation, whether it's attitude, relate that to the real world, that is the key to retention, in my opinion, and not so much. I mean, Jeepers, Steve, as you know, in my particular style of karate, we have 8 forms. We've never varied from that. That's the traditional Okinawan Weichiru kata. So it's really not about teaching something new all the time. It's about having a nice understanding of how this stuff, I don't care what kind of curricular it is, Taekwondo, whatever, will aid me in my life. Because I guess another way to say it is, really excellent teachers will teach their students and show their students how they have to transcend the physical. Because if it's just based on physical alone, it'll be short-lived. And I'm talking about having students that are there for 20 years, for 25 years, whose son goes there, whose third generation goes there. That makes running your school, even by the time you get in your 50s, so much nicer. And what happens is you become so much highly thought of in your community and so much respected and by the police force, by the civic groups. And I think that's how martial arts should be perceived, because of all the benefits we have. And I think we'd all agree that if everyone did martial arts, it would be a way better society, because everyone would have so many more wonderful characteristics that have been developed in them.
You know,
I ramble on. Stop me if I talk too much, but
I believe
so wholeheartedly in this, you know?
Let's put this in context for everybody for a second. Is with 350 active students, how many new students are you adding on an average month?
4 or 5.
Okay, so you're maintaining 350 active with 4 or 5 new enrollments a month.
Correct.
And you told me when we were talking a couple weeks ago that when you looked at your latest billing report, that the average student on there was, what, 55 months?
Yeah, when someone walks through the doors, the average student is 54 payments, which is, you know, 4.5 years. So that's, you know, we have people, new people that just come in, and we've had people with, you know, 128 payments, you know, 180 payments. So about 54 payments. And I think the national average is somewhere around 9 months, I think.
Yeah.
You'd know that better than I.
Well, our target for our peak performers in Air Circle is for them to be average a minimum of $200 average revenue per student, and which obviously you're right there. And then the other question is how many enrollments they need per month is dependent upon how good their retention is.
Right.
And up in your neck of the woods, Jonathan Metcalf, who's one of our Inner Circle, we just went through his numbers, and he has similar retention numbers once he's run them through his first 3 or 4 months and really had a commitment to the retention or to black belt. We were finding that he was dropping out like 0.1% per month of those people. But it's so important, because if you know, if the school is dropping out, I'd say the industry average is 7% or 10% a month. So if you had 350 active students dropping out 10% a month, you'd need 35 new students a month.
Right.
And if you're dropping out 7 a month, you'd need 23 or 24.
Hmm.
And if you were dropping out 5%, you'd need 17. And, you know, you just keep going down the list.
Right.
And, I mean, you're close to 1%, a little, probably 1.2 or 1.3% a month.
Hmm.
So it really is that combination. And I don't want anybody to miss the point. With 4 or 5 new enrollments a month, you're maintaining an active student body of 350 with an average revenue per student of $200 a month.
Just tuition, right?
And exactly, just tuition, you know, without retail or anything else.
Right.
And so obviously that brings it up quite a bit above that. The other thing you said, and I want to go back to it for a second.
Sure.
See, our industry has, for some reason, and I think it's because we're all martial arts nuts, but for some reason, everybody is so focused on curriculum that they think that the way to fix their school is add an additional layer of curriculum, do some new thing. And, you know, as you and I have been, I opened my first school in 1974 as well. Mile High Karate in Denver, I started in 83. But, you know, you go back to the trends of Kung Fu and Jeet Kune Do and Kali or Eskrima and cardio kickboxing and now Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and there's a bunch of other stuff in between. But we all get fixated on it's about learning some new thing and teaching some new thing. But what you just said very clearly, which I couldn't agree with more, is it's not about the new thing. It's about the life skills, confidence, character development. Expand on that a little bit. Your students are how do you focus them on that personal development aspect as opposed to just the physical?
Well, through little subtleties that are done so subtly by our teachers and by myself, I guess. If you take a shy, newly promoted brown belt and have him do a form or a kata in front of, if he's ready, in front of a class of 20 other students, and then after he does it and you say, you know, that's great. I know you're going to show that confidence tomorrow at school or whatever. So we just, even if it's a half sentence or a sentence in terms of, wow, you showed great patience working with that junior student. I bet you can use that at work tomorrow too, couldn't you? I bet you could use that in traffic tomorrow. So we're constantly doing things like that. And that's, you know, how many of our students are going to get into a fight, you know? But how many of our students are going to need confidence, patience, determination? So we rarely let, you know, a class doesn't go by without that being mentioned subtly and not making a big deal of it half a dozen times. So people just see the need for those types of things. Those things don't go out of style. You know, everyone wants to be confident. Everyone wants to have more patience. And if you can, as an instructor, say that, hey, you do this curriculum, you follow this vehicle, and it'll happen for you. And if they see the teacher exuding that confidence, they'll believe in it. No written word nor spoken plea can teach our youth what they should be, nor all the books on all the shelves. It's what the teachers are themselves. So but that's from John Wooden's book, by the way. But if I act confidently and if I really, really believe in this curriculum, well, that's what got Durkin that way. I'm going to follow this route. They will as well, regardless of what the curriculum is. And it's very difficult for your student to believe in a particular curriculum if you're jumping from pillar to post, like you say, every time a new fad comes out. Well, what do you really believe in? So physical, of course it's physical. We know it's physical. It has to be. That's what got you and I involved in it anyways. But at some point, you've got to transcend the physical because it's so much more if you want to keep people and have them make it a lifestyle. And here I go again. When they make it a lifestyle, it just makes your job as a business owner so much easier and so much more pleasant and so much more fun and so much less pressure, which is a wonderful thing. And I feel badly when I can see someone who's had a school for 10 or 15 years or 20 years and they're calling me and talking to me, and I can just tell they're having the same challenges that they had when they first opened. And it doesn't have to be that way. You know, I think it just doesn't have to be that way. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, what I tell people is that the value of learning to kick and punch is somewhere between, or to grapple or choke somebody out, somewhere between $50 and $80 a month. And every other bit of value that we impart, and the truly invaluable thing, and I mean, you can always make the argument that, you know, the woman that keeps from getting raped, or the person who, you know, the child who keeps from being abducted, that it was priceless. But as you said, that's such a rarity, truthfully.
Right.
That the priceless piece of this is the life skills. It's the confidence and focus and character. And what I feel the problem in our industry really has been the last few years is there's been a trend back towards martial artists thinking of a school as a gym, and there's been a pollution of the language of thinking of themselves as a coach and thinking of their membership as being like a gym membership. What's your take on the last few years and what's been happening in the industry?
Well, I would agree with that wholeheartedly, and we're not a gym, and we're just a different animal, and we can't compete with a gym at being a gym. You just look at the rates, and they don't offer what we offer. So I think you're right. That's a bad trend, in my opinion, and I think martial arts is unique, and martial arts is different from the workout or whatever and at the gym, and there's just so much more that is taught through this wonderful thing we call martial arts, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, the teacher's job is really quite simple. It's just simple. And if every teacher could do this, every school would thrive. And the teacher's job is simply provide the proper dojo atmosphere. People say, what do you do? Well, I try and provide the proper dojo atmosphere. And if a student can really sink, if an instructor or business owner or whatever can sink his teeth into that, what does that mean? You know, that provide the proper dojo atmosphere, dojang atmosphere, whatever. And that's, are people cooperating? Are people working hard? Are people being respectful? Are people showing patience? Are they showing effort? And that's really all the teacher's job. You know, sometimes I'll teach a class and won't say a heck of a lot, but the proper atmosphere is being maintained. And that proper atmosphere is vastly different from a gym. Vastly different from a gym where there's probably a lack of cooperation and lack of interest in other people, and are seniors helping juniors, are juniors helping seniors. So I think the teacher's job is, if they can get around that, it's just provide the proper dojo atmosphere. And if the teacher is doing that, then everything takes care of itself. People will love to come to that atmosphere. And it truly should be. And I think it is a unique atmosphere. And it's so totally different from the gymnasium atmosphere.
Yeah. And the our mutual friend Keith Affner, to echo something you said a minute ago, his quote was, most of us should love our students more and our martial art less. And
exactly.
I thought it was an interesting way to look at it is, as a teacher, most of the industry, frankly, which is why they're suffering, they're so focused on the technical of what they do that they're not focused on being a developer of people. They're working on mastering some new kick, punch, grappling technique or whatever it might be, which
right.
is not the root of what we're doing.
No, I don't think it is, and I would agree with Keith 100%. Again, we'll go back to people first, martial arts second, or everyone you're trying to teach that technique to, first and foremost, is a human being with a heart, with a soul, with emotions, with feelings. And that's, you know, you could, the technique is important. Of course it is. You and I both know that. But if you just base it strictly on that, that gets old. Well, okay, I've went to a few tournaments. I've won every tournament, you know, or I can spar better than anybody in the school. That stuff is very short-term, three, five, 6 years, whatever. But the other stuff that you're talking about, the life-affirming skills and stuff, just blend so naturally into the curriculum. And yet when you present it like that, the students don't feel a burnout. They say, man, I need this. I got to go back. Now, I think that's the essential part of what we do. There's a million... And I'll give you a list of 500 accidentals, accidental versus essential. Essential is the proper thinking, providing the proper dojo atmosphere, thinking long term, thinking in human terms. And you couple that with accidental, or having the place exceedingly clean, having the staff be warm and friendly and welcoming, and on and on. And you do that, you're a winner. And people will just love being there. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. 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 I couldn't agree more. Let's try to give some practical action steps. And, where I get complaints from people a lot of times is you and I are perfectly aligned. I think so much of this stuff is about your personal mindset.
Yeah.
And then it's about the culture you build of the people around you, more so than it is about action techniques particularly. And
bingo.
It's fine to create the 300-page operations manual, but companies large and small. I heard Tom Peters say many years ago that the only purpose of an operations manual in a company is to pull it off the shelf, dust it off, and look at it when something goes wrong to figure out who's to blame. And I think that's right. It's all about the culture you develop. We both suffer from a. We can say this because we both suffer from a mutual affliction of having an MBA. So, that business background, we can be heretics, I guess. But when you bring a new student into the school, how do you prep them and introduce them to a culture that's unfamiliar and get them comfortable with that early on? What are some practical steps on how you introduce that to a new student?
Well, that's a phrased in an interesting way. We don't make a concerted effort of doing it. They just are immersed in the politeness, the courtesy, the welcoming. It's not something we make a point of. They just are immersed, I guess, are just surrounded or embraced by and welcomed by the people who are there. Unlike 30, 40 years ago, senior students didn't want new students coming in because it took time away from them,
yeah.
as you'll remember. So when a new, I know from the initial phone call, I mean, all kinds of technical things, Stephen. Still people, I like to say it's demand language versus request language. I still talk to dojo owners, school owners across the country, and people put you on hold, and it's always demand. Hold on. And right from the start, request language, may I ask you to hold? You know, another one of my pet peeves is even over the phone, you know, with so-and-so, yes, I'll get him, no problem. I hate no problem. It's always my pleasure. So,
exactly.
You know, this practical thing, so someone calls up and they're greeted by name, they know the person to whom they're speaking, they're greeted comfortably, spoken to in request language, not demand language. My pleasure to get Mr. Durkin, my pleasure, may I ask you to hold, and just little things like that. So when they come in, that's even magnified more because here it is in the flesh. Example, and I'm not, it's just a fact. I'll give you two examples. I have a third degree black belt, 20 years old. He started when he was like, I don't know, 7 or 8 or something like that. And he's 6'4". We had a student walk in, a 5-year-old walk in with his mother, and I was coming out of my office. I hadn't greeted them yet, nor had our program director. And this black belt just took a look at them, walked over to the little boy, got down on one knee, reached out his hand and said, "Hi, I'm Matt. What's your name?" No instruction. No one told him to do that. He's not on the payroll. That's the culture of the dojo. If you were to walk down a hallway in my school, Stephen, and there was a piece of paper on the floor, like a crumbled up piece of paper, a 5-year-old would walk down and pick it up and throw it in the trash. You'd say, "That's impossible." No, he would. And here's why he would. Because he's seen the 45-year-old do it. But he's never heard Mr. Durkin say, "Pick that trash up." Nobody's seen Mr. Durkin do it himself. So we inculcate that culture, like you said. We build on it with the seniors, and it just trickles down because the seniors were once junior students themselves. So,
an interesting story that brings up, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the you know the story of when GM bought EDS and Ross Perot suddenly became the largest shareholder of General Motors.
Okay.
And there was immediately it was oil and water. They didn't mix. But Ross Perot's comment is that at EDS, and he phrased it this way, he said, "When we at EDS, you see a snake in the road, you kill it. And at General Motors, if there's a snake in the road, they form a committee on snakes and a committee for the humane treatment of snakes and a committee for the proper elimination of snakes. And 6 months later, they fixed it." And
yeah.
One of the stories about Ross Perot is somehow he had intercepted a little old lady who had a problem with her Ford or her Chevy or Pontiac and personally had arranged for a rental car for her, personally had arranged a mechanic to go fix it, and he got into all kinds of trouble with everybody else, keeping in mind he was on the board of directors and largest shareholder, because his reaction was to go fix the problem, not
right.
to let it linger. And
right.
you know what you're describing there is that leadership by example, and what's so important. Evil Valley and I used to have this conversation. We were tended to be on opposite sides of thinking about it. But all of the character development things that I always wanted our instructors to teach, my process is to have them reading a book every month and discussing it, and having them listening to a tape every day and discussing it. And I wanted them to become what it is we were teaching,
right.
and then to discuss it in class, rather than to give them a script that I expected them to read it.
Beautiful.
And it seems like that's so much more important because the students model what they see as opposed to listen to what you say.
Yeah, it's very important. We, to all our teachers, we have to model it. we have to teach it, and we have to expect it. All three of those, not one of those three can be left out. You have to model it, you have to teach it, and then you have to expect it. And if you just do the first two without the third, nothing. So those three things are very important. And I think another very important concept that will help school owners is understanding the difference, what I call the breadth of what you do versus the depth of what you do. The breadth, the superfluous, if you will, the breadth is the technique. The depth, that's where the key is. The depth is the relationship formed by your developing the technique for the student or with the student. So the breadth is the technique, the wide, okay, this technique, that technique, this technique. The depth of what you do is the relationship that's formed by developing the technique. And it's all relationship-based. You know, at our school, ask anybody, we never do a transaction. We always do a relationship. It's just, we always do a relationship. It's never a transaction. It's always a relationship, win-win for everybody. But the depth of is based upon the relationship. And if you can develop that, we call it that sacred space between the teacher and the student and among the students, boy, that's special. Everything's at our school is built upon relationships. And, you know, it's pretty much like that. If every teacher carried it further, because why do people study with anybody? They study with anybody because they like them. If someone doesn't like you, they're not going to study with you. It's that simple. Every student thinks that their sensei is the best in the world. Wouldn't you agree? And if they don't like them, they don't stay with them. So build upon that. Develop a relationship. And I'm not saying they have to get into your business and know everything about you. Far from it. But build a relationship where you're sincerely helping each student. Hey, I know how this martial art helped me. If it can help you just a fraction of what it did for me, you'll be great. And when that's communicated verbally, physically, any other way with your student, they really respond to that, and they respect it and appreciate it.
Well, and of course what you're talking about is that starting with you, all of your staff, all of your black belts, is you're a product of the product that you're selling. And
yes.
The second thing, then, is it's about creating that personal-professional relationship that's
yes.
a mentor-teacher role. And, you know, we all know, one of my pet peeves is, you know, the instructors who go out drinking with their students or dating their
right.
students and all that kind of stuff. But you're not talking about becoming buddies at
no,
the,
not
at
the all. Not familiar
one.
At all.
Yeah.
No, God, no.
And that's a good term. Not about being familiar. And what we're always looking to do is have a great deal of depth and knowledge about our students' life from the standpoint of it's all useful to help them develop to their fullest. Frankly, without them knowing much of our non-professional life.
I think that's very true. We don't even want them to know where we live. Just kidding.
Yeah. Well,
it's true to
us. I see a lot of people who cross that boundary and then don't understand. And again, think of any context.
Relationship
and a quality university.
It's not healthy. I think the students should see you as just that, their teacher, their martial arts instructor. That, you know, people will look at me and they'll say, boy, Mr. Durkin was really together today. He made the right decisions. All these big, strong, powerful black belts listening to him. They don't come home and hear Judy yelling at me, Stephen, you know?
Exactly.
And I don't want them to.
Exactly.
That was
yeah.
a joke.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
No,
but,
well,
you know,
I
had a, I think, here's an example. Not too long ago, a school owner called me. And we were just talking, and he was asking some questions. And then he told me, like, well, last weekend, a half a dozen white belts went over and helped him paint his house.
Mm-hmm.
And I cringed when I heard that. You don't want the white... I just cringed. Like, well, no, they're my friends, they're the white belts, they haven't proven a thing, you know, and I wouldn't have a black belt do that. But it just struck me as, boy, this familiarity you don't want.
No. And, you know, and what people miss is that if you're teaching success skills and teaching confidence and teaching discipline, if they ever see that you don't have that, is you've lost all trust.
Exactly.
And, you know, and the more human you become to them, and I don't mean that in the wrong way, but
yes.
you've got to walk the talk, and at the same time, we are on stage. And so we don't want them to see us in off stage out of that role.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true. You put it more eloquently than I can. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, so important. The thing that, you know, many of our members aspire to be or are multi-school operators, and I know that's not where your focus is.
Right.
But I was having the conversation actually with Frank Silverman recently, and from a multi-school standpoint, everything that you said is much more important than even in a single school. And it's frankly more difficult to develop because
sure.
What we were talking about is, you know, some of his operations and the challenges is in creating that culture and indoctrinating each new staff member into that culture, which is why it's very difficult to bring somebody in from outside that you haven't grown from within.
Yes,
but
I would agree.
You know, we see organizations. I like to study West Point, but we see organizations, and the U.S. Marines is one of them that are very good in a fairly short period of time of indoctrinating people and socializing them and getting them to have a common worldview. But from a multi-school operator, that was really 99% of my focus over the years was how do I create and maintain that culture and how do I create the training process, especially for people who haven't grown fully from within,
right.
Of getting them to indoctrinate and to understand that. And what you've described is so important, that culture of politeness, that culture of courtesy, that culture of, I'm sure everybody knows everybody else's name or tries to.
No, of course
knows
they do.
The parent. Yeah, yeah.
But, you
well,
know, the thing, all these things you're mentioning now doesn't diminish one's martial arts skills one iota.
No, not at all.
You know what I mean? So to have the... to have the wonderful martial art physical skills plus this, that's huge.
Well, going back to our mutual MBA, the studies have shown that the number one reason somebody stops the MBA business, the overwhelming reason is perceived apathy.
Wow.
And see, it's all that stuff, right? I mean, I can go to a dry cleaner's that knows my name and is nice to me when I get there and doesn't ask for the phone number and, you know, picks my stuff up. And I'm not hypersensitive about whether they missed a spot or not, right? But if they're not of that level of friendliness and so forth, then I'm going to be hypersensitive about everything.
Yeah.
And it's so important.
I'll give you something practical for the guys listening. I call it the triple A theory, and it backs up just what you said. The triple A effect, if you will, at our school is that you have to have an awareness, an appreciation, and take action. Those three A's. So what do I mean by that? An awareness of what's going on in your student's life. Just the other day, I was talking with a mother, and the younger sibling who is not a student got a little gold medal at an Olympic, a little gold medal at a little 8-year-old tennis tournament. Now, this kid isn't even a student at the school, His older sibling is. So I have a little notebook right inside my gi. I just jotted that down. Before I go home for the night, I write a little card, congratulations on getting your gold medal, way to go, and I mail it out. So we have an awareness. We have an appreciation. That meant nothing, not a lot to me, but it obviously meant a lot to that family and to that little boy for that mother to tell me that. And I didn't just absorb it. I took action on it. Another one of my longtime students who just got a new car. Great, congratulations. A used car, but he was so thrilled with this new used car. I went home, thanked him. Before I went home, I thanked him for showing me the car. I had him drive it around the front of the building. We sat in it. And the next day he got a $25 gift card for gas for his car. So we do these types of things, these little, it's just an awareness. What's important to someone? You don't want to always, you know, when you can get something from them. You have the most effect on people when you're out of their sight. So if someone gets a thank you card from me and they're not in school, in the dojo, they haven't been there in 3 or 4 or 5 days, that's way more meaningful than my saying something when they're right in front of me. So we try and develop an awareness, and even though an appreciation, even though it doesn't mean anything to me, boy, I appreciate what this means to you. And then finally, take action on it. And doing that repetitively just makes it fun. I don't think of it as a chore at all. I like acknowledging success and happiness in people. And that just pays off in spades. Boy, the school's thinking of me when I'm not even there. So-and-so's not even a student, and he got a little kudos card. I think that type of thing is very, very powerful if you do it sincerely. And it's quite easy to do, just an awareness of what's going on with your students, an appreciation, and just take a little action on it. And that's very powerful, and it's a lot of fun. I don't think I've gone to work, Stephen, a day in 38 years, because it's fun, and I like to do it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and something about what you're talking about there that, you know, people may miss. See, I see schools who, you know, you get 100 karate bucks if you refer a friend, and then are surprised that people aren't, like, appreciative of the reward they gave them, right? And that's just so manipulative, and you know, not that it doesn't work, but what you're talking about is unexpected, it's sincere, it's not in exchange for them having done something for you, because we've all been conditioned for the idea of reciprocity. And if they did something for you first and then you do something for them, they don't particularly appreciate it. It's expected. But these things that you're talking about are in exchange for they didn't have to do anything other than you care about them as a human being, and you're recognizing and rewarding things that are important to them. And it's so many people try to then systematize something like this. And what they do is they take away the thing that made it about the human being.
Yeah. You know, I have a rule here with my seniors and the people who help us teach and other dojo owners, you know. Never expect gratitude, but always show appreciation. Some people are offended. You didn't even thank me for that. Never expect gratitude. You don't do something to get gratitude, you know, but always show appreciation. And even on the little things, never expect gratitude. Always show appreciation. It's huge, and we both know that people will be callous, and people can be non-thinking, and people can be hurtful. So what? Karate has taught us to have a thick skin. So what? So we don't worry about that. But you know, the biggest thing I'm appreciative of every day is that every single student that comes to my school could be somewhere else. In the wintertime up here in New Hampshire, they could be by the fireplace drinking a hot chocolate. They could be at a sports bar with a cold beer eating popcorn. But where are they? They made the time to come to the dojo. So we appreciate that. You know, in the summertime, they could be out in the screen house or swimming in the pool, but they're not. They come to the dojo. So I think school owners have to appreciate the fact with all kinds of students, even your most challenging students, they're there. And I appreciate the fact that they came there. By virtue of their coming, they're showing a little faith in me, and I am obligated to reciprocate and try and give my best so that they'll benefit from it. I think we just have to be appreciative of every person that walks through your doors.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you had mentioned something earlier in the conversation. I wanted to circle back to it, if you don't mind. Is you had said that school used to have a higher active count at one time, but you're very comfortable now at 350. And
yes.
I wanted to get your take. Is so many of the people that we work with are always thinking about more and more students. And from a financial standpoint, I think it's about a proper balance. There was a book that actually John Paul DeGiorgio, Paul Mitchell Companies recommended to me by the name of, it was called Pursuit of Prime.
But Pursuit of what?
The Pursuit of Prime.
Prime, okay.
But the premise is it's not about always having more customers. It's about maximizing the relationship with the customer, the revenue per customer, and the profitability. And I know that with 500 or 600 students, it's much more difficult to do all these things that you're talking about than it is with 300 or 400. I've always considered 250, 300 to be that prime number, where if you get to 250, 300 plus, you're really maximizing your revenue, all the pieces fall together well. What's your take on that?
My take on that is, yes, and, you know, we've all gone through growing pains, but when we had as high as we were up at 550 students, and I didn't know everybody. I didn't know what parent belonged to which child. And with that, with so many students, I mean, it's just so much wear and tear on you emotionally, the building, the facility. And now we have, like I say, we keep it at 350, and we've never had more income. So we went up on tuition, provide more service. We never go up on tuition without adding something of more of value. That's the key. And the people accept it. And with the higher tuition, the tuition going up, we get a more dedicated student. We're able to do more with that student. So for me, anyways, where we are comfortably now, it's just beautiful. You know, a lot of new school owners think it's about how much money you make. And it's not. It's about how much you keep. So it's not about how much money you make. I know lots of school owners, they're making a ton of money, and, you know, one half of it goes to rent. A quarter of it goes to rent, and the rest of it goes to salary, and they end up with nothing. So it's not so much, hey, I'm grossing this. That doesn't mean anything. What means the most is how much you're keeping. Do you agree?
Well, I would say it, and I know you agree with this, but it's how much you keep to the bottom line.
Yeah.
And it's about the lifestyle that you develop for yourself.
Right.
And it's about the depth and quality of your reach in the community to make it sustainable. And so without any one of those three things, I see a lot of people, and some of my former staff have tried to go replicate what they thought I did.
Yeah.
And they end up with working 100 hours a week, stressed out, with a good income, but with not much of a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And so it's that combination of, if you're making a positive reach in the community, you know that it's sustainable, because you're going to have friends and family and second generation, third generation, 10, 15, 20 years. And if you're creating it so that you can develop the six-figure or better life income, personal income that you want, but at the same time with the quality of life that you want, as you know, one of the things that I personally decided I didn't want to do is I didn't want to have 30, 40, 50 employees on my payroll. And the quality of lifestyle for me was about having owner-operators in place rather than people who are employees, because, frankly, employees act differently than owners do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're about out of time, Mr. Durkin, and I really appreciate this, but, you know, the one last thing is, you know, our focus within NAPNA the last year or so, and it's really been a stark realization to me, and let me get your take on this, is, As all of us developed as martial artists, I know certainly for you and I, is there were key components. There was the component of knowledge, but there was also the component of having a sincere, focused, capable, knowledgeable mentor who was holding our hand, looking over our shoulder. I know in martial arts as a instruction, you had that and I had that. The other element of it was the peer group of fellow students, some of them more advanced than us, some of them junior to us, the junior students that we were supporting and teaching, and the senior students who were supporting us and helping us along the way. And on the business side of this now with NAPNA, my focus has been increasingly on recognizing the difference between very high performers and those who are struggling. And the realization that it's not about departing knowledge, it's about that mentorship role, having a teacher looking over their shoulder and having a peer group. What would your analysis be of that? Because I certainly know that you've dealt with a lot of school owners who haven't implemented, and, you know, in my case with coaching peak performers in our circle, the thing that we're finding the difference is it's not about more stuff, it's about having that one-on-one teacher relationship and about it being able to be with a peer group and have that support.
Yeah, I think that's great. We have a calligraphy right in our front wall, and it translates to mean sacred space. And it's that sacred space between you and someone you look up to, someone who gives you good advice. I've been very blessed. My martial arts teacher is the same one I started with in 1966, retired, living in Florida now, but I still see him regularly, George Mattson. And I think from a business point of view, as you know, my mentor has been Mr. Nick Kokinos. And I think that the two best things we ever did was build our own building and join educational funding, because that third-party billing just worked wonders for us. It was a beautiful marriage. But I think it's important that everyone has someone who takes an interest in them, and not just a cursory interest, but a real interest in their development, and that relationship, and that idea of someone who's gone on before you to help you is huge. And I think the NAPMA members are I just hope they appreciate what you do for them, because no hearts and flowers here, because I know how hard you work at it, and I know how desperately what you do is needed in our field, truly. So,
and I think you and I were privileged relationship that we were able to develop with Nick early on was unusual. And I was privileged to have that relationship with Nick going all the way back to 1976, and then with June Rhee going back to 69, and with Jeff Smith going back to 1969. And then, as you know, over the years, have developed that similar relationship with Dan Kennedy and others who have been in that teacher mentorship role. And so many school owners understand that was important for their martial arts training, but they miss that's essential for their business development and development as a master teacher as well.
That's too bad, because that's just every bit as important.
How many
wonderful martial artists do we know that couldn't make it as a business? And how many wonderful businessmen we know couldn't make it as martial arts school operators?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, the unfortunate reality is most. And the X factor seems to be that having a mentor that's been there, done that, looking over your shoulder, having that personal relationship that gets developed, and having the peer group. And again, frankly, no different than what you're talking about with your students. You really can't ship your students a DVD of the new form quarterly and expect them to become accomplished martial artists. And you know, I've talked to people who've been getting the information from NAPMA or other companies for years that are still at $5,000 a month and struggling. And the ones that we're working with on a more personal coaching relationship are going from $5,000 to $35,000 to $55,000. And I'm sure you would agree, in the process, in I'd say 100% of the cases, but in almost all cases, their student quality is improving, the quality of the relationship with the student is improving, or else they wouldn't be making those strides.
Yes, I think that's true. And it's important to... it's important to utilize the tools that are available to everyone, to all of us, on a martial level and certainly on a business level. I mean, those who dare to teach or lead must never cease to learn, and I love that. You know, if you're going to teach, you're going to lead, you got to keep learning. Or if you don't, you're just going to fall by the wayside and do a disservice to the people who want to study with you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think we've gone over our allotted time here, Kirk, and if I have your permission, I'd love to do this again sometime soon and keep expanding upon your huge breadth of knowledge.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, and I hope that was beneficial. And I enjoyed speaking with you, as always. I have the utmost respect for you and for what you do, Stephen.
Oh, thank you very much, sir.
All right.
So goodbye, everybody, and until next time.